You're listening to Pirate Cat Radio, KPCR LP 92.9 FM Los Gatos, and KMRT LP 101.9 FM Santa Cruz. Tony Duchesne here, and welcome to December 2025. What? How? Yeah, I know. As Roberto Benigni said in the film Down by Law, it's a sad and beautiful world. Hey, we've had a bumpy ride. We've had ups, we have downs, but 2025 is not quite over. Tony, are you going to tell us about your screenwriting workshop during the holiday break? Well, there's 6 spots left. Register now for the screenwriting workshop happening during the holiday break for 2 weeks. December 22nd through January 2nd. We start from idea to detailed 50-scene outline, all the while the people and normal people out there, the happy families, share hot cocoa and sing jingles. Now look, I'd rather have a sane family that did that. I'd kill for a hot cocoa and a hug from mom. But some of us don't get that, and that's all right. And some of us do. And that's all right, too. If you have a festive season with hot cocoa and cheer, we adore you. If you're a bit of a loner, a writerly type, then let's get to work. There's a link at drinkswithtony.com to register. It brings you to the right spot. Easy to register. Get in the class before we fill up. I want you, dear Drinks with Tony listener, because I feel we connect. I feel you're a story dork just like me. You want to learn to craft. You want to learn the 3-act structure. You want to learn plot twist. You want to learn character arcs. You want to join the filmmakers club, us produced screenwriters who sit and would rather cut our teeth on pen and paper than sit in a room with a healthy, well-adjusted family. You'd rather craft your screenplay, show the world who you are on the inside. Through pictures at the multiplex, through big-time digital streaming platforms. They all start with an idea. Then they turn into a screenplay, not magically, through work and persistence. And thus, I urge you to join the screenwriting workshop I'm teaching during the holiday break. Information and registration link at drinkswithtony.com. That's drinkswithtony.com. Who knows? You could be the next Lee Goldberg. Or wait, you could be his younger brother, Todd Goldberg.
Hi, this is Todd Goldberg, and you're listening to Drinks with Tony.
Get on the Drinks with Tony show. Yeah.
Oh, you delight me. All right. You're listening to Drinks with Tony. I'm your host, Tony Duchesne. Today on the show, we have Todd Goldberg. He's the author of Only Way Out, a novel. Todd, how are you?
I am doing fantastic. Listeners can't see this, but I already have a Christmas tree behind me in my office.
What?
It's November.
Hold on.
Jewish.
I know.
I have a Christmas tree.
Yeah. How does that happen? Because you are defying the faith of your people.
Well, I married my lovely wife, Wendy. Nearly 30 years ago, and my wife is a big Christmas person. And so we have not one, not two, not three, not four, not five, but I think 6 or 7 Christmas trees in our house.
Wow. So do you do Christmas and Hanukkah?
We celebrate Hanukkah by lighting the candles, but we open our presents on Christmas Eve. So we do everything. We do a little bit of everything.
Oh,
because look, it's important to get gifts.
Yeah. Well, I'm just thinking of the beautiful flickering lights in your house for so long. Cause that brings two different holidays together. And then you get like an extra week or two or whatever of let's light it under a candle. Let's make this beautiful fire element.
Our house is a glittery, beautiful, golden light, just palace of holidays. And there's the light up advent calendar. There's the small Christmas city There's a series of things I'm not allowed to touch called ornaments. A whole mess of stuff.
And I mean, the only reason you'd want to touch ornaments is, for sexual pleasure. So I'm sure
Yeah,
that's the reason why they're keeping you away from it.
that's a niche on the internet that I'm not willing to visit.
So Wendy's Christian. I mean, or does she just comes from a Christian background?
Yes, from the
Okay.
background. Yeah,
Yeah.
she absolved herself of all faith at about 5 years old.
Oh, so how, th this is what blows my mind is when women are smarter than men, because like everyone who, if for the people know, some people know I grew up a Jehovah's Witness, but like everyone I grew up with, all the women I grew up with, they were like, oh yeah, we knew it was BS when I was 15. And I'm like, how did you know? I was still like in it mentally until I was 30. I still thought it was like, how
See,
did.
and we primarily grew up without any religion, which is odd because my grandparents escaped Russia in 1919, and my mom and her siblings were, first generation Americans. But by the time I came along in January of 1971, we had absolutely no religion whatsoever. We had a Christmas tree my entire life. The only time I really I wasn't even bar mitzvahed, which is unusual for a Jew of my standing.
Wait, and you still
But
not?
no, never was. Which is odd also because I wrote, a bunch of books about a rabbi. And
Yeah.
it wasn't until I wrote those books, and when I wrote the books, the Gangsterland series about a hitman who hides out as a rabbi, it was after my mom had died and my dad was already dead as well. And that was the point at which I read like all the holy books and everything because I was going to write about this rabbi. And I didn't know enough about my own sort of background to speak to it on the page for sure. And what I found was a deeper connection culturally, but not religiously. I mean, I'm a fairly pragmatic person, and the spiritual world seems like a thin veil sometimes between us and reality, but I don't believe there's some entity who's judging me. I mean, other than like say like Dave Navarro or something.
Yeah, or Kirkus books.
Yeah, Kirkus is my Lord and Savior. They did give me a star this time to
Dude, you
own
got a
it.
star, and they didn't
Yeah.
give you a star on the Gangsterland books?
Oh no, they did. I've
Oh,
received,
okay.
I mean, that's not, I don't
Uh,
want
yeah,
to,
yeah. Okay,
yes,
come on.
so many, in fact. But it's always
When
a
have you not
surprise.
got a star in your, like, has Publishers Weekly been good to you too?
Publishers Weekly has been very, very good to me over the years as well.
Okay,
Yes.
wow.
The only time I got a bad review in Publishers Weekly was for my first book, which came out 25 years ago. And I got such a notably bad review then that I was like, I'm going to try to write better books going forward.
Hey, that's funny. It's like taking the criticism without ego. I don't know if you know that YouTube channel and radio show Film Courage. They've like interviewed me a bunch of times, and what they do is they like tape you for like 4 hours and drill you with questions, and then it comes out in 10-minute segments.
Right.
And the commenters are pretty much mean, right? And
Right.
I'm not going to
It is the
reply. Right, but I read all the
internet.
comments because I'm not famous. So
Dude,
if there's 60 comments, I'm reading every
you
comment.
can't read, never read the comments. It's like going on Goodreads at 3 o'clock in the morning to find out the truth about yourself. You can never do that. Like, if you're having a crisis at 4 o'clock in the morning about who you are, don't go on Goodreads to figure out if it's accurate.
That is so funny. I even forgot what we were just talking about.
Oh, taking criticism to heart.
Right. So, but someone said, "Will you tell that guy to clean his glasses?" And I looked at the, and I was like, "Oh, he's right." So when they invited me out for the next taping, I was in their bathroom cleaning my glasses, and I told, and they were like, and I was like, "Hey, I know the comments are, back and forth, but this one guy said his glasses were dirty, and I'm really glad I read the comment because now I'll look cleaner for these
Yeah.
segments."
Well, what's interesting is I have an essay that's coming out in Alta, the wonderful magazine Alta, about my writing mentor, a man named Tom Filer. who I worked with for, gosh, almost a decade. This is in the 1990s in LA and then early 2000s. And this the essay goes into this in some depth, but he had received a review of his first novel in 1961, and then he never wrote another novel. He got a bad review in the New York Times in 1961, and that was it.
Wow.
Couldn't take it. And part of what the essay talks about is that he then sort of imprinted his regrets about that onto me, like, oh, you know, don't write books. The New York Times will savage you. Critics will savage you, all of these things, which I've been trying to reckon with over the course of the last, like, 35 years since I worked with him.
Yeah.
Trying to figure out, like, why would he do this? And I love this man. I really did. And I still love him. He's long dead, but I still love him. And the thing that was remarkable is I went and I read the review of his book, and the thing was, the review was right. And I think that's the hard thing. I think sometimes about getting criticism is it hurts more when you know it's true. And in your case, it's like, you know what, Tony? Go to LensCrafters, get that little rag that they include.
Who knew?
And then use it, for God's sake.
I've been using dish soap with a little bit of water.
Yeah, that's all you need.
I am so like, I do that every morning now. And it's all because of David 443762 that I've changed my life.
The man saw into you.
Women are looking at me differently.
he almost saw. Like, if he had actually seen into you through your glasses, imagine the kind of life you'd be living now.
Exactly. This guy was a monk that was like really high up in one of those that people, and someone like dropped their phone when they went up there to get the knowledge, and he just went, "What is this? This man's glasses are dirty."
Does this guy just have greasy thumbs all the time? What the hell is wrong with this guy? Are you eating barbecue?
That is funny. What was the name of your first book? I know it's going to be something that I remember.
It is, and it's right there behind the Christmas tree. It was called Fake Liar Cheat.
Yeah.
And the review was correct.
Yeah. And that's right. I'm glad we came back to that, because this is what's interesting, because as writers, that's when we become writers, I think, is when we realize that it's the process, not the outcome. Even though the outcome's great,
100%.
It's the process.
Yeah, and you know, I think about this a lot now in my life. I'm 54 years old. This new book that you have in your hands is my 16th work of fiction. And then there's two book, like, guidebooks I wrote, and every anthology I've ever been in. You know, I've been in like 35 books or something.
And didn't you write the Burn Notice books?
I think
I read both of those. I love Burn Notice. And I was like, wait, Todd novelized some of this? I'm totally reading those too.
I wrote five of those a million years ago. But when I look back, you know, I started getting published when I was 24 years old. Like, my first short stories started appearing in magazines and journals when I was 24 years old, which is crazy. Like, that's nuts.
Yeah.
My first novel came out when I was 29 years
old. Wow.
And at the time, I was like, I'm late. I'm so late for this.
Isn't it, like, crazy?
My life should have already been started. Like, and now, having run an MFA program for almost 20 years, and my students mostly are in their 30s, I think, like, it's bananas that my first novel came out when I was 29 years old. It's ludicrous that this happened to me. And so I think you can only have a long career as a writer or an artist in any form by not just reckoning with the criticism of your own work, but by recognizing that what we do is not done in a vacuum, and that everything that you do is up for discussion, even if what you're doing is talking and your glasses are dirty. Like, that's part of the deal is you're in a cultural conversation. What you're doing is going to be put up for examination. And as a young person, I think that's hard, because you feel like you deserve whatever you're getting. And now I realize, like, no, you don't deserve anything. Mm-hmm. And it's part and parcel to this life, to this career. So to go back to the larger philosophical issue of your own life, Tony, Don't seek out bad reviews. Don't go to the comments and see, like, did they say that I'm fat? They said I'm fat. I'm fat. Okay.
Oh, my God. So the first time that Film Courage taped me was, like, right at the end of COVID when things started opening up.
Right.
And they had the – so they taped me behind – the interviewer was behind a screen. She was – they were both, like, masked up, and I was one not masked up in the room. And but I had just had about, let's say, 14 or 15 months of a diet of two bottles of wine a night and cheese, because we're all going to die anyway.
Right. I remember those times. Yeah.
So I was the fattest I had ever been in my life.
We all were.
Oh, my God. It came up in my memories. And I saved the shirt I had for that recording because I couldn't button that shirt. And now it wraps around me almost twice. And I'm just like, I'm glad I got out of that lifestyle. And
yeah.
And next pandemic, I'm a yoga instructor.
Dude, it's taken me a full 2 years to lose exactly that same weight. So
I am
100% with you.
Yeah.
Because I mean, it's true. Like I never drank more in my life than during the pandemic. I never took more gummies in my life than in the pandemic.
Yeah.
You know, The amazing thing also is that I was super prolific, but that's because I wasn't leaving the house.
I was the opposite of prolific. I was, I just finished ghostwriting maybe about nine. I was on like the ninth book of ghostwriting for the Vanity Press because, you know, to pay the bills, you got to sometimes pull up your skirt and walk down Santa Monica Boulevard. And,
A lot happening there, Tony.
I should have waited until you sipped your drink.
You've revealed more than I'm comfortable with, frankly.
But after that last ghostwriting gig with most of these people were writing self-help books because they listened to one audio book with Tony Robbins, and they've never been a writer in their lives, and they wanted to get out of their dreary lives by writing how great their lives are, and they can too. And so it took, like, COVID hit. I couldn't write a thing for about 8 months. Like I just had to, like, sit there and, like, I got to learn how to get it out of me faster, but COVID hit. And so that kind of throws everything off. But
yeah,
the writer's energy, like protecting that energy is important.
Mm-hmm. For me, it was the only thing that I could control. And so I found that very cathartic to be able to sit down and write and feel like I was God, and therefore I'm going to control who lives and dies. And, you know, I was writing my own book, so a lot of people are going to die. But they're the people I chose. But, you know, to have dominion over chaos in my head just for the hours that I was writing, I think is what actually kept me from losing my mind.
Yeah.
Because at the time, I was adapting my Gangsterland books for Amazon. And, you know, we were working on it, and it was, you know, that was great. And then right when the pandemic hit, that died. And then I wrote a collection of short stories and then worked on another novel. So, like, all sorts of cool stuff was happening at the same time. But, man, I don't yearn for those days.
No. I like going outside and being irritated with the stupidity of people. And that kind of just reminds me how judgmental I am. And also that there's people in the world.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm a inveterate eavesdropper. So, like, if I'm feeling blocked or whatever, the best thing for me to do is just go to Target and, you know, buy some omeprazoloy and listen to people, you know, listen to people complain about whatever their problems are, or shop. And losing that was one of the harder things for me, was just like losing the chance observation of people in the wild.
Yeah. The thing I realized that I still do a lot is I like to see people reading books. And the minute I see someone reading a book, I walk up to them and go, "What are you reading?" And you know, usually she stops coloring her book and she goes, "Mommy." No, I'm kidding.
That's dark.
And cut. No, I mean,
it's dark.
No. Like even
dark.
I was hanging out at a cafe. I think it was yesterday, the day before. And this, I was, I just said, what are you reading? To this woman who was reading a book, because I want to know what everybody's reading, because who reads books nowadays? Everyone's right on their devices. So if someone has a book, I want to know what they're reading, because that's important to me. And I write it down and I put it on my list if it sounds good. But and I did that with I was walking up by this kid. He was reading The Count of Monte Cristo. And I was just like, dude, you're in for an undertaking. Do you like it? And he goes, it's fantastic. And I'm like, get out of here. He's like, no, really, you have to read it. Like, he was sitting there like for it. And I'm like, okay, I'm going to get it. And I'll read 50 pages and I know I'll hate it and it'll be dumb. I read that thing like it was a Bible, and I was, you know,
there's a lot of cool, weird shit in that book. Yes. I read that young. Yeah, I probably read that when I was 17. You know, and then I saw that movie Sleepers, or was that what it was called? Sleepers? No. What was that movie? It was based on a book about those kids at a boys' school. Was it called Sleepers? Brad Pitt and Kevin Bacon and Jason Patrick.
Frightened? No, wait.
What the hell was it called? It might have been called Sleepers. I'll have to look this up. But they go back to their boys' school and kill a guy or something.
Oh, I don't know. Okay,
kill the evil guard. But it's basically The Count of Monte Cristo also.
Wow.
You know? Because they had all read that and, you know, decided to take revenge on somebody.
And it blew my mind how much it meant to me in my 50s. And I don't know if I would have liked it if I read it when I was a teenager.
I think there's a lot of books like that. I think there's the other day a younger person asked me if when I read Catcher in the Rye, if I wanted to shake Holden Caulfield or if I wanted to be Holden Caulfield. And I was like, dude, I wanted to be him.
Oh, yeah. Like,
100%.
Yeah.
And my friend Mitchell, who asked me this, he's like, yeah, see, I read it and I was like, well, this is a crazy person who needs to get help right away. And I said, yeah, I read it in like 1982. we didn't have that language yet.
Yeah. And I read it again a few years ago for the second time. The first time I read it, I was like 30. So, because I came to books late, you know this about me. I'm like, talking about coming to books late. You had your first book published before you were 30. I just started reading novels.
That's crazy.
But
I mean, when I was a kid, reading was the only thing that made me feel normal, basically.
Yeah. See, reading was the only thing that made me feel abnormal because I was reading the Bible and Watchtower literature.
Right.
I was reading a lot. You know, I got to say, the Jehovah's Witnesses helped me to read. I got the muscle to read all the time because they made us read all the time. So it was kind of cool that I got to turn it over to novels, and I still have to read every day constantly. But reading soul-enriching stuff, not apocalyptic.
And it must have taught you, you know, to appreciate magical realism.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Maybe, you know, I'm not a fan of that genre, and that might be why. Because
I got news for you.
Yeah.
If you pay me $30 an hour for about 30 sessions, we can get to that.
We're getting to a lot of my problems and solving them in this episode, which always is
Problems with Tony is what the show's now called.
The other book I read this year, which I brought with me to France, and I didn't have a book because, you know, when I travel alone, I need a wife. But instead of a wife, I get a book. And so, you know, wife may come down the road. You know, my second marriage will be failed, and then my third will work, and I'm still trying to find the second. But I brought Les Misérables, thinking that I was going to toss it when I got to Paris and go into Shakespeare and Company and just get something else. Oh no. That was another book that was like life-changing. I'm like, I'm going through all these middle-aged geriatric life-changing books. It's like when I was young and found books, I'm finding books in a new way that I would have never read that are not hard to sludge through. They're just, it's like their time is now, and it makes me feel alive.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the gift of wonderful literature is it's not just timeless, it's a time machine. You know, it lets you know that the things you're feeling at any given time, people have felt that way forever. And that gives you, when I say that, books made me feel less weird when I was a kid, that was true. It's like, oh, I'm not the only person who at 12 years old or whatever has felt this way or wanted to be this way. Like, I remember reading Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy by Douglas Adams when I was very young. I was like, 12 or something like that. And I was a weird kid with a weird sense of humor who became an adult who's weird with a weird
Yeah, I was
sense
gonna
of
say
humor.
was.
Yeah, so not a lot has changed. But to read that book, which it's some high level satire, not just of science fiction, but of culture in general. But to see the way Douglas Adams perceived the world as absurd and ludicrous and not evil really changed the way I think I perceived my own reality as a kid. And that really mattered to me as a kid, like, with a crazy mom and, weird shit happening in my house, that if I went and sat and read that book for 2 or 3 hours or whatever it was, it would transport me somewhere else and let me know that what I was experiencing at home, there was actually a stop, that there was a door out at some point. It was turning 18, but that door was going to close behind me, and I wouldn't have to live in that situation anymore. But that's just what great books do, is they teach you not just empathy, but give you I think, an insight into a life that you can lead when you get to make your own decisions.
And also just the beauty of the mythology of that moment in time. Like it's almost a cultural snapshot of reading certain eras. And even going back to like Gangsterland, which is, like right now we're in an era where things have changed like a lot in the last decade. So when you look at a book 10 years ago, you feel like it's almost like we were on another planet 10 years ago.
Yeah, and it's funny when I think about those gangster books. I wrote 4 of them, 3 novels and a collection of short stories about this hitman who hides out as a rabbi, and then the stories were sort of surrounding that character. And a lot of what I was writing about was, what I've always written about, which is about identity and about who we are at any given moment to the person that's in front of us. And that people will believe what they want to believe in order just to sort of live their lives. And as I wrote it, I was watching the world change in front of me. The world that I wrote about, I mean, the books take place in the early 2000s, but I wrote them in the mid 2000s. My thoughts and feelings about the world changed dramatically in the 12 years between starting the first book and the last book coming out. But what it turns out was that the world was exactly sort of what I thought it was going to be. I just didn't know it. That, thuggery and mendacity would rule the day, and people wouldn't care as long as they got theirs. And I think sort of examining the American dream through the notion of how it's changed. It used to be go west and, find your freedom, and now it's, go west and see what you can get away with. And I think, like, that was something I'd been writing about in those books. And then it just turns out now that that's just our daily life. You can live on the line between criminality and a normal life. You can do it publicly. And if you do make crimes, eh, oh well, it's fine.
Do you think with this is something I've been trying to grapple with because sometimes I feel like authors have, sometimes an insight into the future that they don't even know, right? And it's but I wonder if we're I'm gonna get like woo-woo esoteric hippie over here.
We're
So
both
hold
in Northern
on.
California. We're used to it. We both
No,
grew
but
up with
it's
our parents in cults.
right. I like, is there energy in the air that we're feeling when we're, because I don't, as a writer, like often I feel like I'm channeling more that, like sometimes I'm like, when I'm writing, I'm writing ahead of myself where I don't even know where it's going to go, but the writing's going somewhere. Do you feel like there's like an energy channeling of sorts where maybe we're tapping into something that is showing us where civilizations moving? Like, because collectively, I think we do a lot of things that are so similar, and then all of a sudden, the same kind of the same stories all come out at once. People go, "Oh, they must have ripped off that. They must have ripped off this." But it's just like, no,
And it's just
I
an
think it was
undercurrent.
just all in the air.
Yeah, I mean, I think about how Graham Greene predicted the total outcome of the Vietnam War in The Quiet American, like predicts every single aspect of the Vietnam War in The Quiet American. And you know, he's just a writer with you know, who paid attention and good insight. For me, you know, what when I was writing the gangster books and then with Only Way Out, the new book, you know, what I have seen and what I think I'm exploring is that, you know, people are trying to get away with whatever they can. People want to be famous for getting away with whatever they can. They want the spotlight even when they're doing dark shit. Oh, pardon me, dark stuff. And because of that, our ability to divine what actual goodness is has disappeared. We never know if someone's on the level or not. And you know what I saw when writing about organized crime for so many years, and the new book has an organized crime element as well, is that there's not a lot of difference between, say, the Bonanno crime family and Countrywide Mortgage. You know, like there's not a big difference between owing a bookie a bunch of money and owing Visa a bunch of money, except that a bookie will stop coming after you. They'll break your leg, they might hurt you, they might even kill you, but they will stop. Visa will never stop. They will always come for you. 25 years from now, your Discover card that you use to charge a bunch of liquor at a gas station in Northridge, this sounds oddly specific, I recognize, and then cut up and then never paid, they will still call you about that. And like that just never ends. And it's something we now expect, that you can expect that the mob is always going to come for you now. And they won't stop. They don't stop. And I think that's something that I've been writing about for a long time, and that we're now seeing sort of every day in our regular life, is that the internet is forever. Grievance is forever, and people will never stop coming after you if they feel that you are somehow the other to them, or you owe them money. And
The other thing that's, I was just thinking of this, and I
if
don't.
Discover Card's listening, that wasn't me.
No, Discover Card, we love you.
Oh, do you know anyone? Tony, this is an important question. Do you know anyone? Have you seen anyone? Like you're out to dinner and you're like, oh, are we paying this together, or splitting it? What are we doing? And they're like, no, I got this. They drop a Discover card on
I don't think
the
I think I saw the last time I saw a Discover card might have been around 2005. Do they even still exist?
They do, because they have commercials where they're like, you might think people don't take the Discover card, but over 96%, and like, ah, I must live in the 4%.
I think I think there's a lot of 4%. 96% of Arcadia.
Yeah, 96% of the border cities between here and Nova Scotia.
It's like 4 out of 5 dentist surveys recommend sugarless gum for the people who chew
I
gum. And you're
mean,
just like, where did they say that?
when I was in college, everyone I knew was defrauding their Discover cards.
Really?
Yes. They would set up a booth at Cal State Northridge, and you could just sign up with any old information. They'd be like, here's a Discover card.
Oh, yeah,
And
that's
they'd give you
right.
like your balance would be like, you know, $200. But in 1992 in Northridge, $200 was a lot of pizza and beer, my friend.
$200 is like 20 records.
Yeah. It's a lot of used CDs at Moby Disc.
Oh crap. When I worked at where was I working at? It was like Nordstrom or Macy's. I worked at the cologne counter, and I was with this other dude, and they had this promotion for like if you sign people up for the Macy's card, then you get at least $20, but you might get $50. And guess what we stopped giving a crap about selling, which was perfume. We started selling credit, and we were selling it to, it's just like, oh yeah, this is cool, but check this out, if you get this you can like have a credit card today. And they're like, I don't even have a credit card. And you're like, no, but we'll get you one. And yeah, even if they denied, we got money. So yeah, it was just like we turned into telemarketer douchebag bankers. And but hey, you gotta make a living.
But that's the thing, like this sort of gangsterfication of American commerce is something I've been writing about now for a long time in this new book and in the other books too, is like everything that we do, you know, we're kicking up to some boss somewhere who's getting rich off of someone else's, you know, sort of vague criminality.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think, to your original question, like are authors or artists or whatever predicting the future? I think what it is when you get people who are particularly perceptive and look at the world and you know, see patterns and all that stuff, you know, what we're going through is not anything new. You know, right. what we live in is nothing new. It's just that for the first time in a long time, like organized criminals, like the mob or street gangs or whatever, people will just say, I'm ripping you off, and it doesn't matter.
Yeah. It's almost like thinking about like the mob in Sicily and stuff like that, where the mob has more honesty than the corrupt government.
Yeah. I mean,
it's just like, hey, we can do this for you, but if we do this, we're going to hurt you. So right. Do you really want to do this? Or you could just be in the corrupt government system where they're like, oh, we're already hurting you.
Yeah.
Without you knowing it.
I just think that, you know, what we're seeing reflected through our media, and like with movies, it's always about 18 months behind because they shot it 18 months ago.
Right.
But what we're seeing now and what we've seen sort of historically is like when bad things happen in America, you see it reflected pretty clearly in the arts. So, for instance, when you think about the Depression or post-World War I, essentially in America, that's when you see the rise of noir fiction. You know, that's when you see the rise of detectives.
Yeah.
Because what we're looking at is a corrupt world where no one's on your side. So you have to either take the action into your own hands or hire somebody because there's been a failure in law enforcement and you need someone to solve your problems. This is also when you think about sort of the rise of the superheroes post-World War II, same thing, like who's going to save us? Well, our government isn't going to save us. That country's not going to save us. The only person that can save us is a space alien in a cape.
Yeah.
And so now I think when you are, you know, people might feel helpless or whatever. They watch a lot of true crime.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of the new book that the Only Way Out is dealing with sort of the true crime industrial complex. Because the nice thing about true crime, if you're watching a movie or you're watching a documentary or you're listening to a podcast or you're reading the book, is that at the conclusion of a true crime experience, chaos is resolved.
Yes.
Someone finds the body.
There's
justice.
Someone
solves the murder. Someone finds the money, whatever it might be.
Yeah.
And in a time when we feel super powerless from the world itself coming down on us, someone else solving a mystery for us is extraordinarily edifying. At least to me, it is.
Yeah.
And that's why my wife and I watch Dead Girl Missing documentaries every night before we go to bed. It's like,
before you go to bed.
I found her. I can go to bed. Well, there's this show that my wife Wendy's been watching a lot lately. It's called Buried in the Backyard. And the
sounds porn.
It's great. And you'll be surprised that they find the bodies at the end of each one buried in the backyard.
And it's satisfying.
It's extraordinarily satisfying. And then there's companion shows. There's Buried in the Backyard. There's Buried in the Desert. There's Buried in the Lake.
Oh, wow.
There's a really good one called Buried in the Snow.
I was going to say, like, is there a glacier one yet? Because maybe we could put that together and make a ton of money.
We could probably put that together, but it's always like...
In the fjord.
You know, she went missing in the coldest winter in record in Tahoe, 1977. She's in the snow.
She's in the snow. Dude, look in the snow.
Yeah. Has anyone looked in the snow yet?
I can't watch true crime stuff. I really wish I could. I can't watch it just because I think I just come from such pathology that it's just like I feel like I've already had too much of it in my life.
Right.
I do love, but like bringing up the noir and how like noir came up and the detective solving the story, like it's so interesting. And even going back like to the Count Monte Cristo and all that is we just want things to be fair. And I think you think about that, like even when you're at a grocery store and someone cuts in line, how agitated everyone gets, even though it's just like a ripple of what do you call it? Just a little bit of a disturbance and maybe a little bit of a delayed time.
Right.
But because it's not fair and we weren't respected, that's why it's a problem.
Yeah.
Where it's and I think we're always tapping that in stories. It's like what's fair, what's moral. And as writers, we're always, because you can't give certain anti-heroes a total victory
Right.
because they have to come to consequences with their morality, but that's how we get them in a certain spot where they just get enough victory.
Yeah, and I think that's something I've tried to approach in my work all along. And I mean, it really sort of goes back to the sort of iconic line in the Maltese Falcon where Sam Spade says, asking a detective not to solve a crime is like asking a dog not to chase a rabbit. A dog might not do it for a little bit, but that's not its nature. And
Yeah.
eventually it's going to chase the rabbit.
Yeah.
And I think sort of talking about people's true nature as it relates to crime fiction, is something I've always tried to do, because I don't think that I mean I've never really written heroes. I've always written bad guys, but I try to write bad guys that have a code, a moral center that's their own morality or their own logic. We might not line up with yours, but by the end of the book or the end of the stories, you understand why they've made the choices that they've made. They might be aberrant, but at least they'll be entertaining.
And we're satisfied because they stuck to the code. So even if their morality was totally off point, they stayed on that same morality. And it
Yeah.
refreshes us because we see people shift so much. When we see people shift in life, that like that's chaos to our brain. So
Right.
to carry on with someone who has the same moral code through a whole novel or through a
Right. The
entire team.
consistency of their messed up moral code, I think, allows you to write about characters in an interesting way. And this is probably why I don't write heroes. I feel like heroes have one track. I'm going to save the day. That's their track. Whereas a anti-hero, which I think I've literally built the house that I'm sitting in on.
This is my anti-hero house.
Yeah, I mean, it
We'll go to
really
my hero's
is.
journey house in a
My
minute,
hero's
but
journey house is backward. I always think like that I'm trying to write about people that are not great, that are trying to be good. And I think that allows the reader to feel some sort of empathy, not sympathy, but empathy. Because I think, sympathy for a reader is pity. Like you pity that person and the things that they've done, the choices that they've made. And I always want the reader to somehow imagine, like, well, what would I have done in this situation? Who would I be if I were this person? And that allows you to have the reader change allegiances that they would normally have. So, like in the new book, when I'm writing about, a bunch of bad people doing bad things, it's levels. Like there's a crooked cop, but he's still a cop. So, are you supposed to, at some level, respect him because he's the law? Or to respect these criminals that are doing criminal things, but they're doing it for the right reasons. They want a different life. They want to get out of the bad situation that they're in, whatever it might be. They're not hurting other people. I mean, I like to leave the reader wondering about their own fungible moral center while they're reading a book.
Well, I think all readers are needing to question their morality. Is that they're not consciously doing it, but there is a bit of of gratification when we see other people doing the bad thoughts that we may not have in our that we may have in our mind, but we don't act on. But when we see a character act on it, we understand how a character can get there.
Yeah. I'll tell you a funny story. Do you know the writer Joe Loya? Have you ever met Joe?
Oh, I love him. Yeah.
So I love Joe too, and we're
Yeah.
pals. But this was several years ago. I hadn't met him in real life before, and but I had been reading his stuff for years and years, and I would
Yeah.
quote him in lectures I was giving. And
Yep.
the first time that I met him was after I had done a talk at some writers' conferences like 10 years ago, and
Yeah.
I got an email the next day with the subject line, "I heard you were talking about me," and I was like, "Oh God." And so for the listeners out there,
He's
Joe,
such a
well, Joe did serious time. Joe did
Yeah.
7 years in San Quentin and
Yeah.
somewhere else too. He like 7 total years though
Yeah.
for bank robbery. He tried to kill his father when he was 14 years old.
Yeah.
Just
He was
he was not a
world-setting bank robber. Like
yes. Like he was not a great guy. And then while he was in prison doing like 7 years of solitary, they finally got him on meds, and he was like, "Oh, huh, I don't want to kill people." Like untreated bipolar his entire life, probably. So anyway, but he has written really articulately subsequent to getting out of prison about the criminal life and about his thought process and how he did things when he was robbing banks and the guys he knew and all this stuff. So he sends me this letter. I was like, "Oh God, like, what have I said? Like, am I a dead man?" And he was just like, "Oh man, I'm a fan. I love your work." And I was like, "Oh, thank God." And so we started this friendship. I'd never met him in person. And I was up in the Bay Area where he lives, and he was like, "Oh, let's meet for coffee." And so we met for coffee at a Starbucks in Orinda, where if you're not familiar with Orinda, all the parking is diagonal and all the streets are sun-dappled. That's all you need to know about Orinda. And he walks up to the Starbucks. Joe's a big dude. Joe's running an easy three bills. And walks like he's still on the yard. And I saw people sort of like visibly like, "Who is this guy?" And then he walks into the Starbucks and people are just like sort of freaking out a little bit. And he's like, "Hey man, my daughter gets this purple drink. Do you know what the purple drink is?" And I was like, "I think it's a hibiscus tea." He's like, "Yes." And he goes and gets the hibiscus tea and he comes back and everyone's like, "Well, this guy's not going to kill us. He's got a giant hibiscus tea. It's purple." And so we're talking and people are eavesdropping because we're telling stories. I can tell they're eavesdropping. He's telling me prison stories and stuff.
Yeah.
And I finally said to him, like, "Why do you read my stuff when you've done all the things that I make up?" And he said, "You and me, we think alike." And I was like, "No, we don't." And he's like, No, we do." He said, "Sometimes you're in an elevator and you think, I'd like to smash that guy's head against the wall." And I was like, "I do think
Yeah.
that." And he said, "You want to know the differences between you and me?" And I said, "Yes." And I won't use the word that he said, but what he said was, "The difference is you're a wimp." And I was like, "I am a wimp."
Yeah, please
And
don't hurt me, Joe.
he's like, "Never learn how to fight." And I was like, "I will never learn how to fight." He's like, "Because I did those things." He's like, "I would
Yeah.
never do them now.
Yeah.
But when I had no impulse control, I had those same thoughts that you've had that you've channeled into your fiction."
Yeah.
And that was really sort of like an eye-opening moment for me. Like my entire life, I've always imagined sort of criminal situations. And I've always been looking around at everybody, like wondering who the bad guy is in any given situation, or how to get out, or how to blow something up, or whatever it might be. But
Yeah.
I then put all of that into my books.
Yeah.
Joe put it into his life.
Joe did it the other way.
Yeah. But now Joe puts it into his work, which is great. But all this to say, when I think about this thing that we do as writers, it's not that I'm necessarily, it's not like I'm doing wish fulfillment, but I think part of it for readers is like understanding how other people's brains work. That gives you empathy, even when you're surprised by who those people actually are.
Well, and I think that's readers in general, which I have a really hard time being a friend or in any relationship with someone who doesn't read novels, because it just, I'm like, how do you make sense of the world?
Right.
I zone out and, or I get high every day and I'm like, well, that's just boring.
Yeah.
We're all too old for that these days.
Well,
I mean, you know, every other day.
Not enough time.
Exactly. So this was probably around 2008. I was doing an event in San Francisco. I don't know if you remember the Hemlock Tavern. So I was doing an event there, and I was doing storytelling, and I did a lot of storytelling, but I never did it with rock stars like Beth Lisick and like all these people who were on like it was like all of a sudden I was with the rock stars of writers of San Francisco.
Yeah, that period of time when like the Moth was everything.
Exactly, exactly. And so I get up there and I'm like, man, I was just like, I just don't feel worthy to be here because it's just like, I feel like everyone else is Van Halen and I'm Wolfgang just trying to like audition for
hey man, Wolfie's doing great now.
I know this was in the early days of like, let's put Valerie Bertinelli's kid in the band for a second. But the, anyway, so I said that and then I did my thing and it worked out well. Next day, I'm getting all these phone calls from Joe Loya and it's scaring me to death. Cause it's like, homeboy, call me back right now. And I'm just going, I didn't want to call him. And he was texting me and he's like, yeah, he's like, I need to talk to you. And I was like, my heart was like going, oh my God, what did I do to Joe? Like immediately I'm like trying to rack my brain before I talk to him. And I'm like, what am I apologizing for? Right. You know? And so I was at this place called Maxfield's Coffee. I think it's on 17th and Dolores in San Francisco. I remember this specifically because of the fear. I walked outside, got on my phone, and I'm just like, okay, here we go. I'm gonna get my ass chewed out by Joe Loya right now. And he's all, homeboy, I'm glad you called me. We gotta talk. I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. And he's like, never talk yourself down. You went up there and you told a great story that was probably better than maybe half of those people. But what you did is you talked yourself down. And then what it does is it makes everyone think that you're not as good as anyone else there. And you got to stop doing that because you're just starting to work on your, he just like, and I was just sitting there going, wow.
Yeah.
So then I went and told my other writer friend, I don't know if you know Alan Black. And I was just like, Joe, and Alan was at this reading, and Joe, and I was like, dude, Joe Loya called me, and like, it scared me to death.
The man knows things.
Yeah.
I love that guy.
And Alan Black, I can't do his Scottish accent, but he's just like, he's like, God. Oh, Tony, he's all right. And I'm just like, whoa. He's like, I'm glad Joe told you that. And I'm like going, wait, did you think the same way? He's like, yeah, but I could never have told you that. I don't know you well enough. I'm just like, I'm going, oh my God. So thank you, Joy Loya, for helping me with my self-esteem. But man, I was scared for a bit.
He's a good dude. He comes out here to the desert quite often. I think he and his girlfriend are looking at a place out here. And so we meet for breakfast at this little diner that I like. Yeah. We sit out there for hours talking our bullshit surrounded by the geriatrics of Palm Springs. And I always just imagine they're like, who on earth are these two people?
Yeah. Well, I'm so happy he got through his heart condition thing. When I was up in the Bay Area, I saw him and I'm just like, hi, stay alive, all right?
Yeah.
Stay alive.
Yeah,
don't do that again. Don't do that again.
Happen.
Yeah. Yeah. This is why I adore the writing community because we end up telling the truth to each other sometimes even when it hurts. And because I was scared to talk to Joe Loya, and I'm so glad he did that because after that he said, own your story. That was his words.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, when I would get on stage for storytelling, there was no introduction. I get right into the story. Yeah. Hi, I'm Tony. Yeah. Boom. And then get out.
Well, and the interesting thing about him too, that I really appreciate is, you know, he judges himself harshly, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He knows that people are interested in his past because it's interesting because he robbed banks. If he were a child molester, people would not be interested in talking to him.
Yeah, and I don't think he would have made it out of Quentin either.
No. And, you know, I think that dichotomy is something that he is more than aware of. And I think that sort of goes to, like, why I watch true crime is like, oh, I want to see justice served to these people. And, you know, if some little kid is abducted and killed, I want to see at the end of exactly 52 minutes, that person get 985 years in prison. Like,
yeah.
I want that. And it's so rare that we get that in life. You have to get it on television. But he's one of those writers that, you know, judges himself really harshly for who he was. And I think that's kind of bracing, you know, just as human beings to meet someone who is really aware of, you know, the hurt they caused other people.
And it's, yeah, and it's beautiful to see that people can change and become amazing. And, you know, and a lot of it, you know, a lot of his work was in meditation too. I actually met him at a reading a couple years before that reading, and he was just there as like some dude. And I did my reading and he's all, "Hey man, who are you?" And I'm all, you know, I told him who I was. And I was like, and he had his book out and I'm like, "Oh my God, you wrote that? Oh my God, I loved your book." I like flipped out. I didn't know. He was just like, "Yeah, man." I was just like, "Whoa, dude, like I read your book the minute it came out because I love those prison stories." Like, like Ed Bunker's prison story where it's just like, I go to his grave when I'm in Hollywood forever. I always go say hi to Ed Bunker.
Yeah. That's a lot. You're not walking down Sunset lifting up your skirt. You go to Ed Bunker's grave.
Well, Ed Bunker is close to Burt Reynolds, which I just found out earlier this year. So now I visit Burt Reynolds as well. And Pee Wee Herman's right there. So there's a lot of people to hang with. Yeah.
In there's a graveyard here in the desert, a cemetery, not a a graveyard, contains something different, I suppose. There's a cemetery here in the desert, and where my wife's grandfather is buried, and he's right down the line from Sonny Bono. So whenever we go to visit my wife's grandfather, I walk up and I say hello to Sonny Bono, and his grave says, "The beat goes on."
Oh, Sonny. You know what we're gonna have to do with this episode is put you know, your face and name and all that really prominent, and then put "With Joe Loya" at the bottom. It's like, because a quarter of this episode's Joe Loya, and when I'm just gonna let him know that he that we promoted Joe Loya when we could, when we were trying to promote Todd's book.
Yes, that's true.
His name is Todd Goldberg. The book is called Only Way Out, a novel. Todd, thank you for coming on the show.
My pleasure. We didn't even have any drinks.
What? Always a fun conversation with Todd Goldberg. Get the book, read the book, and remember, six spots left on my screenwriting workshop happening December 22nd through January 2nd. It's a holiday break. Don't sit on your hands. Don't doom scroll. Come up with an idea and let's write it. I'll carry you through the process one day at a time. Registration link at drinkswithtony.com. That's drinkswithtony.com. It's right there. Welcome to December 2025. Let's make it a good one. I'll see you next week.
Throat. If you move on me, I'm sovereign, 'cause I'm the king of the dogs. Roll out of life, we'll fill you full of cancer. I don't even own a pair of pants. I'm a dancer, baby. Dogs. I'm hanging. things that you cannot smell. I'm deadly. I'm the king of the dogs.